This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Breaking news! President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump have now agreed to two presidential debates. The first one set for June 27th, 2024 on CNN. Wow! First of all, this is, we're only talking May 2024. I believe this is a historic first ever to have a president of the United States, sitting president, actually any president or any candidates ever debate this early. Plenty of debates in the primary process against, for the party nomination against fellow Democrats or fellow Republicans. Never have we had a presidential debate, especially one this early set for June 27th. Here's the story, just breaking on CNN before today's program. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump have both accepted an invitation from CNN to debate June 27th, a historically early showdown that will set the tone for the final months of the 2024 campaign. I've received and accepted an invitation from CNN for debate. Over to you, Donald, as you said, anywhere, anytime, Biden said. Trump later told CNN, the answer is yes, I will accept. And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. I kind of like it because instead of having all this build up, I think it helps all around. Everyone gets to see early on. Then we move into the convention, political convention process. And then, of course, the frantic fall campaign. And I'm guessing the next debate probably won't be till the end of September or October. They have not set a debate. Well, they're saying, September 10th, as I'm seeing here just now. Both men have now accepted an invitation from ABC News to hold a second debate September 10th. And I believe that'll be it. There's always a chance of some mid-October debate. But anyway, very interesting development there. My assumption is that Donald Trump won't even have a running mate, which I don't think he necessarily needs one by this debate in June 27th. But fascinating early development there. So we will keep our eye on that. Well, I can tell you this. One of the issues that President Biden and Donald Trump will be debating is our border. And we just talked about this yesterday with the GOP Senate candidate Hung Cao talking about the open border. And we've talked about Homeland Security Director Mayorkas. This is from NBC News. This is what one of the things they're going to be talking about. A suspected ISIS terrorist from Uzbekistan has illegally crossed the border in the United States in 2022, that was then released by the Biden administration and allowed to live freely in the U.S. for nearly 2 years. You know, it's so funny because they make it sound as though it's just Mexicans and Central Americans and South. I mean, these are poor families and children. They're being separated. We have to have compassion. The border's open. Anyone, anywhere can come in. Now, this is fascinating. I'll talk about this in a minute. This is NBC News. It's the national security state saying, hey, an ISIS terrorist, it's against Biden, who they want to win. There's a lot of other stuff going on here, but we'll get to that in a second. Let's watch NBC News report on this ISIS terrorist who's now entered from Uzbekistan and allegedly lived here for 2 years because the Biden administration allowed him in and freed him. Clip one, NBC News.
Tonight, among the record wave of migrants crossing the southern border, a suspected ISIS member who lived freely in the U.S. for nearly 2 years. Two U.S. officials tell NBC News. 33-year-old Jakovir Atoyev of Uzbekistan crossed into Arizona in February 2022, where he was apprehended and vetted by both Customs and Border Protection and ICE. He was not on the U.S. terror watch list, and he was released into the U.S., those sources tell us. Then, in May 2023, Uzbekistan put out an international alert, saying that Atoyev was affiliated with ISIS and wanted there. But it took nearly a year for U.S. officials to figure out the suspected ISIS member was living freely here in the U.S. U.S. officials tell us DHS made the alarming discovery after reviewing Atoyev's application for asylum. Shortly after DHS connected the dots, ICE arrested him here in Baltimore just 2 weeks ago. Former Homeland Security officials tell us his case raises red flags about the vetting process for migrants after they cross the border. Should alarm bells be going off here?
We are in the midst of a really volatile threat environment. Anytime I see a gap in a system like we are seeing in this case, I do have concerns. Anytime you have just a massive volume of people like we do, our systems are overwhelmed and we need more resources at the southern border to properly protect the homeland.
Wow. Now, taking that at face value, this is what the intelligence agencies are telling, and corporate NBC News, all the people went Joe Biden. They loathed Donald Trump. Why are they releasing this story now? Now, you'd think I'd just be sitting here saying, this is an argument why we should close our borders. And it is. Absolutely. Do terrorists exist? Absolutely. This is a suspected ISIS terrorist. I got to tell you, and this is where I may differ from a lot of other hosts, and I can't even believe I'm saying this publicly. Bullshit. Meaning something doesn't smell right in this story. My bullshit detector is off the charts. NBC News reporting very negative information from this ruling class establishment point of view. A, that Joe Biden's border's out of control. That Joe Biden's made a mistake, administration made a mistake, release this guy. That a suspected ISIS terrorist, which we're supposed to give up everything because we're concerned about, right? Oh my God, this is ISIS. We're supposed to have the Patriot Act. We're still living under a 9/11 emergency declaration. We are supposed to give up, we're supposed to have a surveillance state. We're supposed to give up liberties and freedoms. We're supposed to be on constant watch. We're supposed to allow a huge, massive military, industrial, national security state permanent in the United States because of this ISIS terrorist threat. And here they are, they're coming in. I don't know. It just doesn't. I could care less. I don't want to say I could care less. I don't believe the story. And I think there's another agenda here. Why would they do this? It's either there's a possibility that the story is so bad that known absolute terrorists are coming in and they're only releasing 5% to protect Biden. But there's just no way they would report this. The other angle here is, you know, they're warning us that they're flooding in, you know, potential evildoers, as George W. Bush used to say. And this is another excuse for the Patriot Act II, for more government warrants going after national security procedures that don't require warrants, the warrantless searches. More classification of people as domestic terrorists. We're going to have to give up our rights because the border was open. It's all something very, very, very foul and suspicious about that story. So that's all I got to say on that. But when national security or intelligence agencies tell us there's something that's a threat, I don't believe them anymore. Sorry, don't believe you. You're full of shit. You have violated the oath that you've taken. You violated our democracy. You use fear and propaganda. You're taking away our rights. You're taking away our freedom. You're coming after domestic citizens. And as I said, any GOP senator, congressman who's running, you know, the reason I single them out is because they're the party that's supposed to be against this, at least a wing of that party is supposed to be against it. Obviously, no, you can't say the GOP's against this. One of the first tenets, the first, you know, 5 to 8 platforms is repeal of the Patriot Act. And I would argue, you know, Homeland Security abolishment's a little more complicated because it was a creation of a new agency, but they allegedly streamlined and brought other ones together. I would listen to the case, as we had on the former, you know, deputy, I guess, acting Homeland Security Director last week, that maybe there's some justification for that, but I still would want to strip away a lot of their powers. Just so you know, I love it when government investigates government. I shouldn't say I love it. I mean, at least I don't have a problem with it. And I don't mind onerous regulations, burdens on government. I don't like it on private citizens. Okay. All right, this next thing is on the same theme. Republican Speaker Mike Johnson, the really conservative Christian who adopted an African-American kid who didn't want people to know, but then he did want people to know, and the kid's sort of estranged. Anyway, strange story. He was coming in to save us from Kevin McCarthy. Well, this is U.S. Congressman from Kentucky, Thomas Massie, one of my favorite congressmen of all time. He's on giving the three reasons why GOP House Speaker Mike Johnson has betrayed Republicans. Clip three, take a listen. We have, I guess you would say, we have wolves in sheep's clothing. That's not the right phrase. We have people who aren't what they appear, and another Republican bites the dust. Speaker Mike Johnson, as Thomas Massie explains why he's basically a fraud. Clip two.
Mike Johnson has betrayed us three times.
Yes.
Big betrayals. He did an omnibus bill that spends more than Nancy Pelosi's omnibus bills did, and he gave the FBI a brand new building in that omnibus bill, and he didn't give us time to read it. He gave up on doing 12 separate bills. That was the first betrayal. Second betrayal, FISA. This is the spying program that's been used to surveil Americans without a warrant. He cast the deciding vote on whether to have warrants or not, and he voted against warrants. This is against what he stood for when he was on the Judiciary Committee that I serve on with Jim Jordan. So something has changed there. He said he spent time in a skiff that changed his mind. Guess what, Glenn? I don't know if your listeners know this. I spent 3.5 hours in the same skiff with him, getting briefed by CIA, NSA, DOD, FBI, and DNI, and a FISA judge. And in 3.5 hours, they didn't give us a specific example, not one, of how spying on Americans without a warrant has helped them stop terrorism. They gave hypotheticals, but no example. So that was the second betrayal. No warrants. Now you can still be spied on. It's reauthorized. Third betrayal just happened. This one we're still stinging from because you may have seen the videos that every Democrat in the House voted for money for Ukraine and then premeditated, passed out Ukrainian flags, and we're all waving them and basically humiliating us.
Yeah.
And I think Speaker Johnson, if he's capable of having shame at this point, should have been humiliated by that display as well. I put the video of that on Twitter, and the sergeant at arms told me it would fine me $500 if I didn't take it down. So I reposted it.
I love Thomas Massie, congressman from Kentucky. I don't know enough. I don't know. I mean, I'd love to have Donald Trump pick someone like him. That's not going to happen, obviously. I am really concerned about who Donald Trump may pick. Marco Rubio, no. Doug Burgum, no. Tim Scott, no. I mean, I'm pretty much full of no's. There's really not many GOP people I like. Rand Paul, yes. Thomas Massie, yes. Only 20 Republicans voted against the hate speech bill that they passed recently. Which is, you know, what they said they were against hate speech legislation. Now they're for it. Only 20 Republicans. So Donald Trump has a very thin bench from which to work with. I like Vivek Ramaswamy. I like Colonel Douglas McGregor. I don't even like Ted Cruz for that role. Ted Cruz is too establishment. I'm not sure. Maybe I'm just an outlier, you know. But Thomas Massie really laid waste to Speaker Mike Johnson. I don't get involved in that politics at this point. I don't know about removing him. Marjorie Taylor Greene tried. I think she failed. You know, she failed because the Democrats want Mike Johnson, the new House Speaker in, the GOP House Speaker in, because he plays their game. He's the Uniparty. He's the face of the Uniparty in Washington, D.C. All right, this next one's a little bit silly. It's Joe Biden claiming that he chose Kamala Harris as his VP because he wanted someone smarter than him. I mean, there's a lot of silly things you could say, but let's watch the clip first. Clip three, Joe Biden.
My name's Joe Biden. I work for Kamala Harris. I asked her to be my vice president because I knew I needed somebody smarter than me.
Yeah, I think he may have told the truth there. Kamala Harris, I'm not going to go after her intelligence and talk about anything like that. Yeah, you know, she just seems very vacuous and empty. Doesn't seem like a hard worker. So who even knows what she's capable of? Joe Biden is mediocre from beginning to end. His whole career screams mediocre. You can watch old press clippings from him in the early 1970s, press conferences. He's just unimpressive, even when he was a young man. And what's funny is he was actually a young man. He was really a junior senator. I believe he was under 30, 28, 29 maybe when he was elected, sworn in for U.S. Senate in Delaware. And you could look at his whole career, but that's a funny moment. I mean, he's just talking at a campaign. He's being silly, but it's a funny thing to say because it's probably true. And that's not a compliment to Joe Biden. All right. Moving along here, Steve Malloy, friend of the show, we've had him on, who does junkscience.com, and he's at junkscience on Twitter. As a great, this is a rebuttal to the Lancet, the medical journal, one of the prestigious medical journals in the world, claiming heat waves are killing 30% more in Europe. And we should be afraid of the heat. Heat waves will get you. There's just one problem. It's batshit crazy. It's got no science to support it. All the data goes the other way. If we're in a gentle, anyway, if we're in a warming cycle, i.e. global warming, since the end of the 70s global cooling scare, it means that cold is not as cold, and we are actually a net positive in people living. And this is shown throughout peer-reviewed. 8 to 20 times more people are saved as temperatures go up because cold kills 8 to 20 times more than heat. It's just that simple. Anyway, here's Steve Malloy to break this all down of how medical journals have been corrupted and how they're using just complete fraudulent claims that are absolutely the opposite of what they're claiming. Clip four.
Hey everyone, Steve Malloy here. I just wanted to quickly debunk a new claim from the medical journal Lancet. A new study claims that heat-related deaths in Europe increased 30% over the last 10 years. The fundamental problem with the study is that the researchers didn't actually count any heat-related deaths. Not a single death certificate was reviewed for cause of death. All deaths from all causes were included in the analysis. Deaths from car accidents, deaths from cancer, deaths from drug overdoses, everything. The researchers actually have no idea how many heat-related deaths actually occurred. The study was based on annual death rates. But the researchers didn't even bother to make sure that the deaths occurred on hot days. In fact, even cold weather deaths were counted as heat-related deaths. Climate hoaxers lie as easily as they breathe, and the fake news media doesn't even try to do honest reporting by getting other views. Stay up with the latest on the climate hoax. Follow me on X at Junk Science, and thanks for watching.
Yeah, by the way, he's a great follow on Twitter at Junk Science, if you're on X, Steve Malloy. So that's just one of the frauds that they go around. And again, these are medical journals. These are the exact same medical journals who pushed all the COVID nonsense, COVID lockdowns, vax mandates, mask mandates. And they're the same medical journals that want to merge climate change into the public health threat. It's a public health emergency. It's insane. And this is how they're doing it. One of the ways they're doing it, and they're actually now talking, our U.S. government under the Biden administration is talking about heat wave death toll counts, very similar to COVID counts, COVID death toll counts. And of course, if you get heat exhaustion, that'd be equivalent to a COVID case count. If you die from the heat, then that would be the equivalent of dying, you know, with COVID, from COVID. I mean, who knows? Anyone who dies during a heat wave, say it's they have a criteria 88 degrees Fahrenheit and above, will be classified as a heat wave. So if your 102-year-old great aunt dies, it doesn't matter if she died of, you know, cancer, old age, or a heart attack. If she died during the heat wave, she'll be counted as dying with the heat wave, dying, you know, during the heat wave. So that'll be kind of like dying with COVID when you get a gunshot wound or a car accident. And if you get a heat stroke, or maybe if you extremely perspire, that would be considered a heat wave casualty or heat wave case count, which they could keep track of. But they're actually going to keep track of the deaths, and they're really getting close to treating COVID just like a virus, with all the death tolls, adding it to death certificates, doctors now saying you're suffering from climate change. We've covered that in this program, a whole doctors group in Canada, the first medically diagnosed patient suffering from climate change. All right, just to understand how this insane movement, this is Al Gore and John Kerry predicting that polar ice caps will be gone by 2014. That's right, 10 years ago. And these are clips going back to 2006-07 with Al Gore, and maybe a little later with John Kerry. But they're just wrong every time. But it's like anything else. You keep predicting stuff, something may happen. I've showed you on this program, you can predict opposite results. We're going to have more fog due to global warming. We're going to have less fog. We're going to have more hurricanes. We're going to have less hurricanes. We're going to have snow will be a thing in the past. We're going to have record snow. When you predict both outcomes, pick both teams to win a game, hey, you predicted it regardless of who wins at that point. And that's the climate event. But this is just some of their epic fails. Clip five, Al Gore and John Kerry failing spectacularly to predict climate change.
There is a 75% chance that the entire North Polar ice cap during some of the summer months could be completely ice-free within the next 5 to 7 years.
You have sea ice, which is melting at a rate that the Arctic Ocean now increasingly is exposed. In 5 years, scientists predict we will have the first ice-free Arctic summer.
And they just keep coming on with that. And just so for reference, the Arctic satellite monitoring began officially in 1979. What was happening then? That was the end of the peak cooling period, the end of the little ice age, man-made global cooling scare. So yes, satellite monitoring of the Arctic went on and went online. And of course, we have lost Arctic ice since then. The Antarctic has two components, land ice or glaciers, and also sea ice. Antarctic sea ice has hit record 10 years ago, then it was near record lows. After that, it sort of goes back and forth. Land ice has been pretty darn stable. NASA study, other studies have shown that. Other people have claimed, oh no, it's accelerating the land ice. And then if you look a little closer, they're not actually basing a lot of these studies on data. It's based on climate model reconstructions of some of the ice. So anyway, but that's what John Kerry, Al Gore do. The Arctic ice is still there. And it actually has been on some kind of, I wish you want to say pause, almost, depending on what year, 2012, I've seen the latest data on that. It just fluctuates. It's floating sea ice, does not contribute to sea level rise because it's like an ice cube when it melts in your glass, doesn't overflow your glass. Okay, final clip here. This is the digital ID apparently has passed at least one chamber of government in Australia. And here's the vote, clip six.
The following message from the Senate has been received. The Senate has passed a bill for an act to provide for the accreditation of entities in relation to digital IDs and to establish the Australian Government Digital ID System and for related purposes and transmits it to the House for its concurrence. And I call the clerk.
First reading, a bill for an act to provide for the accreditation of entities in relation to digital IDs and to establish the Australian Government Digital ID System and for related purposes.
I call the Assistant Minister.
I move that the second reading be made an order of the day for the next sitting.
Put the question. Those opinions say aye. Against no. I think the ayes have it.
And there you go. This is actually weird because Great Reset, they don't really like votes of any parliament, legislative body, Congress, anywhere in the world. But when you have young leader programs and you fund people and the corporate government collusion and you have everything from the military industrial complex financing these candidates, this is what they do. These officials in Australia apparently have now passed the first framework for this digital ID. It now gets referred up higher to the other chamber, but this is not something I could imagine ever voting for if I'm an elected official. You know, you do not want to authorize the government to move down this road. And it's kind of like, you know, the idea is, oh, well, there won't be any ID fraud because it'll be digital. No, then it'll be total government control. I would much rather ID fraud. I would much rather virus rates go higher. I mean, not that they would if you don't have mask mandates and lockdowns. Freedom has a cost. Freedom is messy. And freedom is what should be the goal and limits on power of government, not granting them more, as we're seeing here. All right, we have to take a break. When we come back, Linnea Lukin will be joining us. He's a research fellow at the Arthur B. Robinson Center on Climate and Environmental Policy of the Heartland Institute out of Chicago. We are going to talk about climate, energy, and the environment. Join us because Linnea Lukin will be right back when we continue on Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT.
Thank you. In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
Need a ride?
Yeah!
Driving with kids is a big responsibility.
Hop in and buckle up!
So don't sweat the small stuff.
You got paint all over our paper!
Get the big stuff right instead.
What does that mean?
Like making sure your kids are in the correct car seat and buckled up for safer travel.
That deserves a wiggly wiggly wig!
To make sure your child is in the right seat for their age and size, visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Beep, beep.
Yeah. What can I get you guys to drink?
What do you have on draft?
No. We'll have 2 Diet Cokes and a chocolate shake with a cherry on top.
I'll be right back.
Fetal alcohol syndrome is 100% preventable. Prevent it together, because a pregnant woman never drinks alone.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's 1 in 5 daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
I didn't ask to be thrown in the streets, but I did ask for help. And Covenant House was there for me.
For these kids who didn't ask to be put in this unthinkable situation, Covenant House is there. To learn more, go to safeplacetosleep.org today.
On air 24/7, this is today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining the program now is Linnea Lucan, Research Fellow, Arthur B. Robertson Center for Climate and Environmental Policy at the Heartland Institute out of Chicago. She is a graduate from the University of Wyoming in 2018. She has a degree in petroleum engineering, minor in geology, and she has written extensively now and working with Heartland on everything from the climate consensus to fracking to the entire green energy debate. So welcome to the program, Linnea. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, it's great to see you again. Now, you are a young person. I hope you don't mind me pointing that out. So right. I'd like to start there. You recently, not too recently, but out of college. And I just want to know, because it's so rare that you get to get a good feel. You went to school. Where did you go to, like, elementary and high school? Where did you grow up? What state again? It was
Illinois. So I grew up in North Chicago suburbs area.
North Chicago, Illinois. Okay. So I'd like to start out by saying, what was your education sort of on the climate apocalypse? Do you have memories of elementary school, middle school, high school? In Illinois, I don't know if you went to public school or private, but what did you learn about climate long before you ever went to college? Was there anything, did you have an opinion of it? Were you aware of it? Were you aware of Al Gore? Were you aware of any kind of doomsday? Were you skeptical of it? I mean, how would you characterize it? Because this is where the rubber hits the road today, is what the climate youth is what they're calling them. So I just wanted to know how you were raised and how your schooling was on climate.
Sure. So I did go to public school, and it was a very good public school. They have kind of a reputation for being not so good, but I was very, very fortunate. Climate change was very much, even back then, a part of the curriculum. I remember I was in middle school around 2007, 2008 was when I was in seventh or eighth grade. And I had two teachers who made our entire curriculum centered around climate change, whether it was for our math course or our science class or English or whatever. They brought up climate change every situation that they could. And that was actually, it did not have its effect as intended on me. I got annoyed. I had a good sense for feeling propagandized, I guess. And I remember I was dismayed this one time, because this is around the same time that the polar bear stuff was really being shown around in the media. And I had these zoo books, right? And so I was reading about animals all the time. I was like crazy animal kid. And I had one specifically about polar bears that talked about how they can swim for like 100 miles. And I had one of my teachers tell me with a straight face that polar bears weren't good swimmers. And so the ice melting was endangering them because of that. And I was just appalled, because I knew that that wasn't true. And so, and it's a middle school teacher for math or whatever isn't going to be an expert on biology or whatever, but it was an eye-opening moment for me. And there were plenty of others like that, but climate change was definitely a very big part of my science curriculum growing up.
Well, it's amazing. You basically, even in seventh and eighth grade, recognized state-sponsored propaganda. You're really not that far off from what the old Soviets did, North Korea. The idea is this is what we've got to indoctrinate this. What about Al Gore's film? You would have been right around the time he won the Oscar. Did that get shown in your middle school, high school? Did you have to sit through that? Because I remember at the time, this is 18 years ago. There were high schools in America that were showing Al Gore's film. One kid had to watch it four times in four different classes. He saw it four times in separately in four classes. Because, as you say, math teachers were showing it. Who knows? English teachers showing it, because it was the state-sponsored propaganda of the day. But did they ever inflict Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth on you in school?
Yeah, I wouldn't say we had it four times, but it was at least twice that we had to watch it. The worst one to me was they made us watch Gasland, which if anyone is familiar with that rot, it was just, and by that point I was in high school and I really had a much better idea of the reality of a lot of these situations. And they made the mistake of giving us iPads. And so I was looking things up while this documentary was going on class, and finding that most of the stuff that he was saying was easily refuted with a quick Google search. So I was antagonistic towards this particular propaganda ever since I was a kid.
Yeah, I can't remember his name. Josh, the Hollywood guy who made that movie.
Fox.
Josh.
Yeah.
Fox. Yeah. I remember he was showing the flaming of the faucets, and that is something that's been happening for centuries, at least 100+ years to those houses, and had nothing to do with fracking. It was about the local, I guess, the way the methane was in those local communities, and that was not a new development linked to fracking. I remember just that one little thing about it. Well, what about other kids? Were other kids all concerned? So that's my two-part question. Were other students concerned in middle school and high school? And the other question is, did teachers allow dissent? Did any kids dissent, and were they immediately shut down and basically told you're wrong and you can't question this? Or did they allow a good, vigorous debate? Or maybe kids don't like to debate with their teachers too, so maybe no one dissented.
Right. Well, for the most part, no one dissented. I wouldn't say that kids appeared as worried about it then as they seem to be now. I'm sure that if there was a walkout or something that the school staged, the kids would happily go do it instead of being in class. I don't think it speaks very much of the passion that they feel for the subject that they're willing to skip school to go talk about it. But I certainly had teachers who were very good and who did permit some debate in class and would engage with your questions and didn't just shoot you down and tell you that you're crazy. I mean, I had some bad ones too, but it was a mixed bag on that front.
And then what happened in college? Because you would have been going to college, I guess, right before this would have been before the Green New Deal. I guess you would have graduated before that, but right around the time of the rise of AOC. But you went to University of Wyoming. Was that any kind of hotbed of climate alarmism? It'd be hard to believe that was the case in Wyoming, but who knows? It's academia. What was your college education like? Especially if you got a degree in petroleum engineering, I would assume your teachers would be mostly climate skeptics. I could be completely wrong. What was that like?
It mostly did not come up in my coursework in the petroleum department or in the engineering department. There's really...
Which tells me they're climate skeptics, because teachers bring up stuff. And the reason it didn't come up is probably because they didn't want to inflict property. That's my guess. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. But I definitely did feel scared to talk about it in... in my classes, or I was worried that I was wrong on that, wrong that my teachers would take my side on that. Geology department was a very different story. But again, there was some back and forth that was more permissible there. But you would be surprised, even in Wyoming, you know, it's still academia. And so when I was there, the Dakota Access Pipeline thing was really big, and we had massive protests on campus against the pipeline. And so we had, you know, people talking about how oil is killing the planet and stuff for that subject. And we had a like a Believe the Science march or something like that for climate change and for other topics. It was, yeah, it's still a college campus. It is what it is.
All right. So you graduated college with a degree in petroleum engineering. You took geology courses. And what did you want to be when you grew up? What did you want to be a geologist? Did you want to do further education? Or how did you end up at the Heartland Institute doing the great work you're doing now, debunking the consensus, debunking green energy and defending essentially the scientifically fossil fuels?
Well, I wanted to work in industry. I didn't really want to work in public policy. That definitely wasn't, you know, so much on my radar. I did intern with Heartland after I wrote a like a little op-ed after a week of very frustrating climate content in one of my classes. I kind of wrote an angry op-ed that I submitted to Anthony Watts's website, and they took it. And then things kind of spiraled from there. But I went and I worked in industry. I worked offshore in deep water as a what they call a mud logger for a couple of years. And then I just ended up accepting a job offer from the Heartland Institute after I was starting to get a little bit tired of missing all the holidays. And, you know, it's hard work out there. I loved it, but it was also it wasn't a good fit anymore after a while. So. And I'm very passionate about defending the energy industry, not just oil and gas in general, because they certainly kind of, especially the major companies, sell us down the river a little bit on some of the climate issues. Yeah. I was trying to be nice to them a little bit, but they probably don't deserve it, frankly. So that, and then the climate issue, I've always loved science. Part of the reason why I went into petroleum and petroleum engineering in the first place was because I couldn't narrow down what area of science I liked the best. And petroleum really has a wide spread. You can, if you decide after a couple of years of your coursework that you prefer the chemistry side, there's plenty of stuff for you to do there, or geology or physics or the kind of mechanical engineering side. You can go wherever you want with it. So, it ended up being a good fit for me. And I ended up leaning a lot more into the reservoir analysis and geology side.
All right, it just goes to show you, if you're going to write an op-ed, make sure it's an angry op-ed, because that's what gets you the result. By the way, what is a mud logger for our audience? Like, what exactly does that mean? I'm getting the image of you like on those logs where they have the contest and you try to, you know, stay afloat where they spin the logs underneath it. But what exactly is mud logging?
Yeah. Okay. So it's... Boy, it's a little bit tough to explain in a relatively concise way, but it's essentially when you're drilling a well, whether it's an exploration well or you're just starting one in order to kind of get the first couple hundred feet done before you move on to the next one to get the next couple hundred feet done on the next and pop around. Everything that goes... Sorry, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe this. When you are drilling, all of the rock that you're drilling through has to come out. So you need to use drilling mud to help move the rock, to help lubricate the bit, and also to coat the sides of the hole as you're drilling with some kind of a material that's going to prevent fluids from either coming into the well before you intend them to. It also helps you maintain downhole pressure because underground pressures are quite intense. And if you don't have a balanced pressure inside the hole that you're drilling and in the rock formation, you get influxes of gas and fluids when you don't want them. And that's what causes a kick. So we were basically kick prevention or kick monitoring. We made sure that the amount of mud that was going into the well was the amount that was predicted to come out properly. Because if you're losing mud to the well, then that means that you're probably overpressured and you don't want to do that. And if you're getting more back than you intended, that usually meant that there was either gas in the well or some kind of a fluid coming in and you were underpressured. And that can also be super dangerous, obviously. So it's well monitoring. You kind of get an eagle's eye over a lot of different functions on the drill floor and everything. So it was a really interesting job to have.
Wow, that's fantastic. All right, so now you're at the Heartland Institute in Chicago. So you recently did a video titled Rethinking the Climate Change Consensus. This is an example of some of the work you do. So just tell us, like, how do you rethink that climate consensus? We're told, and you alluded to earlier, that you have to support the science. What do you think of when you hear that phrase? And how did they craft this illusion? I mean, at one point, Al Gore and the head of the UN climate panel said the only scientists who don't agree with us are believe the Earth is still flat. So is that true? That's what the public still being told to this day, that there's, you know, the only scientists out there are just stooges for the oil industry or the gas industry.
Right. And that's something that, you know, it's important to combat because, first of all, I mean, right away, the main issue with the consensus narrative is that that's not how science is done. You know, science is not about a popularity contest, or at least it shouldn't be. It should be about the scientific method. It should be about the evidence that's being presented. And if 100 scientists say one thing and they're wrong, but there's only one guy saying the right thing, just because there's 100 saying the wrong thing doesn't mean they're actually right, right? So first, knocking down the idea that consensus is how science should be done in the first place. Second, it's not true that a majority of scientists think that the world is coming to an end. There have been studies. There's one in particular from the American Meteorological Society was polled, every single one of their members. They're the only organization that's ever had all of their members polled on this issue. And while two-thirds of them did say that they believe that human beings were responsible for a lot of the recent warming, only about 30% of them said that they were very worried about it. So it's not a matter of, do most scientists believe that the climate changes? That's a red herring. You know, that's true. A majority of scientists believe that the climate changes. A majority of scientists might even believe that we have an impact on that. But a majority of scientists do not believe that that means that you need to give up meat, that you need to give up driving your car, only buy 3 items of clothing a year, all of the stuff that's policy related that they're using to kind of leverage into our lives.
Yeah, why do you, I mean, I think it's obvious the reason they want to say all scientists agree. And we saw really with the same tactics in COVID, where any scientist who spoke up was either demonized, defunded, canceled, against lockdowns. You know, any epidemiologist, it was amazing to watch. Does that idea of the consensus work with the younger generation? I mean, you have a lot of, you know, college age kids. Do they buy that argument? You think that, well, if all scientists agree, or do people instinctively just push back against that? The people today in your generation, I hate to just categorize your generation, but younger people, do they generally, you know, is that an effective tactic to say, well, all scientists agree, so we should do that?
Well, it's a combination of kind of a appeal to authority fallacy and a peer pressure kind of a thing. You know, you're someone as a young person who doesn't have very much experience in the world. You haven't had the time to read all of the literature on climate change and on, you know, geological history and everything. You might have a decently good grasp of things, you know, if you cared about your science education in school. And so you might have a decent BS meter, if I can use the term. But when you are looked down at by, you know, some famous scientist or the entire US government or whoever, and they say, no, all of these people who know more than you say that this is the case, well, it's difficult to break out of that. It's difficult to push back unless you have really solid evidence to the contrary. And with some of the stuff with COVID, you know, you had, you know, it's kind of a don't believe your lying eyes sort of a situation. You had the situation where people would see their friends catch it and have no symptoms whatsoever. And so they weren't overly worried about it after a certain point. And certainly people my age are not, for the most part, still masking or anything like you see some people doing, poor broken people. But the climate thing is a little bit different, because you have every single news channel on the planet pretty much repeating that every single weather event is tied to climate change, right? So every time the weather is less than ideal for any given situation or for the season or whatever, you're being told that this is because of climate change and that it's going to get worse into the future. Well, that's hard for someone who maybe doesn't have a scientific background to push back against, which is part of why it's so important that we get as much of the actual data that shows that there isn't an emergency out there, so that people can make informed decisions and feel like they're empowered to stand up to the peer pressure.
All right. We're talking with Linnea Lucan, research fellow at the Heartland Institute in Chicago. We have to take a break. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano. We'll be right back after these messages.
When a crisis hits close to home.
Break. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano. We'll be right back after these messages.
When a crisis hits close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve.
Keep coming, keep coming, keep coming.
The demand for charitable services has skyrocketed, and nonprofits are rising to meet the needs. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Honoring. Protecting. Caring. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations of all sizes, across all missions, has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. Together, we change the world. The Nonprofit Alliance.
Prescription drug pricing points to corporate
Freedom of the press is about your right to know. It's about your right to be informed. Today, there are real threats to press freedom and your right to know about the world around us. We must protect our right to know, no matter what kind of news is important to you. Before it's too late, understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
From economics to the woke agenda, this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano. We're talking with Linnea Lucan, a research fellow with the Arthur B. Robinson Center for Climate and Energy Policy at the Heartland Institute, and she has a background in petroleum engineering and geology. Linnea, you see a lot of these young people today, like Benji Backer. These Republican conservative groups, they show up at the conservative conferences, they meet with U.S. senators, they have some members of the House Freedom Caucus, and their message is climate's a problem, we need to have a solution, but the Green New Deal goes too far, we need free market Republican solutions, but they don't challenge really the premise at all. In fact, Benji Backer sat next to Greta Thunberg at a congressional hearing back, I think it was 2019, and he thanked Greta for all her activism and raising awareness on this issue, especially with young people. How big do you think that movement is? Did you have any of those kind of, are there a lot of youth movements that you are aware of that are really pushing the Republican Party basically to be more like Europe, where European conservatives never challenge the premise of climate? They all argue over, not so fast and we need to do it a little slower, but they never challenge the premise. What do you think of that whole movement within the Republican Party? And it's made it to the highest levels. People like Kevin McCarthy, the old House Speaker, was all in on that. He wanted to do carbon capture and plant trees as part of the Republican, Green New Deal light.
Yeah, well, when it comes to the younger people, I think that they're just very poorly informed on the subject. I think that a lot of times, the conservatives who believe in the climate crisis narrative are being kind of artificially propped up, I think, for one, because there really aren't very many of them. Two, I do think that they're savable. because their instincts are good on the policy issue, right? So let's think about it from the perspective of the true believer, right? If you really believe that using fossil fuels is going to end life on this planet, right? And that is the perspective that a lot of these people are taking, is that, you know, 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming over the last 100 years is cataclysmic, which is nonsense, according to all of the available data that we have. You know, weather is not getting worse. People are not going hungry because of this. Crop production has never been higher. Everything looks good, actually, on the environmental front when it comes to climate change. But we've been having this stuff pushed so hard at us from, you know, the moment that we start school, that, like I was talking about before, it's really hard to break outside of that without having access to the data. The thing that makes me suspicious is that these kids should, if they're in conservative politics, they should have access to the data. You know, it's not hard to go online and find the CO2 Coalition or Heartland Institute or any other number of scientific bodies that produce reports that show that things aren't as bad as they seem. So I do question it quite a bit. I understand the impulse of conservatives to try to be kind of pacifying on the issue because of the level of intensity and terror, yeah, frankly, that there is on the side of the people who do believe in this stuff. So there's kind of like a kind-hearted impulse to say, well, no, we'll help you with this, but we just don't want to give up the entire economy to do it, you know? And I think that giving them the inch on this, though, is a huge mistake. I think that they will take a mile. You know, that's what the oil companies tried to do. They tried to give them an inch on the climate change issue. And what's happened now, you know, Exxon is going to have to go in front of a court and talk about how, well, yeah, we did tell people that we thought that climate change was a serious issue. We have this whole sustainability page on our website about how climate change is an issue. But somehow they're going to try to defend that they continue to sell the product that they claim is causing climate change. You know, it's not something that you can maintain for very long. So it is a huge problem.
Yeah, spot on. I've always said, if people believe we face a true national climate emergency and the Republicans are like, yeah, we got a problem, but we can't go as far as that. We can't afford to spend that much.
Right.
We're going to say like, wait a minute, this is the end of society, civilization. We have to spend. They're going to be drawn to the Democrats. That's the problem. It's a stupid political argument and unscientific. You recently wrote an article, is climate change spurring child labor? A lot of people are claiming that it is. And you said, no, but EV batteries are, electric vehicle batteries. What's the story behind that? Why do people think that climate change is causing child labor? We know there's an article of Reuters News actually wrote this. Transgender prostitutes in Indonesia were having their income affected because of climate change, because they're allegedly, I guess, heavy rains or floods have ruined their business and they're not getting as much work. So the question is, are transgender prostitutes in Indonesia, is that a result of climate change? Their income is dropping, and is child labor going up because of climate change?
No, and these are both good examples of a kind of a little pet industry that's popped up in the media the last couple of years. I don't really have a catchy name for it yet, but it basically goes like this. A journalist has a subject that they really want to write about, whether it's child labor, because they did a study on child labor and, you know, how you can try to push companies to not engage in trade with other companies that do child labor or that host child labor practices, or Indonesian sex workers. You want to write about the difficulty of being a sex worker in Indonesia. But how do you, if your editor, if the publisher isn't interested, what do you do to get your stuff published? And that's tied to climate change, whether it's because they can't get it published otherwise, or because they know that the organization that they publish for gets big checks to cover the climate issue, which many of these organizations do, including the Associated Press and Reuters and all of those. So there's a little bit of a small industry that's popped up that is, you know, give me X human interest story and tie it to climate change. And I find it cynical and kind of a little bit gross, actually, because these are serious issues. At least the child labor one is a very serious issue. And there's no reason to think that just because a weather event happens or people are in poverty or something, that it's due to climate change.
All right. Well, we're out of time. Thank you so much, Lenya Lucan, research fellow with the Heartland Institute in Chicago. Thank you for taking the time to join TNT today, Lenya.
Thank you so much for having me on, Mark.
All right. Appreciate it. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned. We'll see you after the break. Thanks for watching.